freedom for the thought we hate.
Treating free speech as a fundamental American value was published, Justice Holmes's opinion, in 1919. But that was a dissent, and the court itself did not adopt that view, the view of free speech as fundamental to our values, for another dozen years.
That's Anthony Lewis talking about the First Amendment. We spoke to him in 2008 about his book, Freedom for the Thought That We Hate. Lewis died on March 21st. And movies were born out of an unlikely partnership between a tycoon and an inventor who was a felon.
The speed with which we consume images today, hundreds each day, thousands each day, is in some ways the result of the tinkering of these two men on a horse farm in California in the 1870s.
That's Edward Ball. He talks with Drew Adamack about his book, The Inventor and the Tycoon, in the second half of the show. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When we first spoke with Anthony Lewis in 2008 about his biography of the First Amendment, George Bush was still president. Concern over the erosion of free speech was one of the reasons Lewis wrote his book, Freedom for the Thought That We Hate. When constitutional lawyer Barack Obama was elected, many thought the erosion would end. But Obama's Justice Department has prosecuted more whistleblowers than all other administrations put together. The most ferocious against Bradley Manning. That sent a chill down the spines of investigative journalists and called into question the president's commitment to protect the First Amendment. Anthony Lewis died on March 21st at the age of 85. We thought it would be a good time to re-air our interview. My guest today, Anthony Lewis, has been writing about constitutional rights throughout his long career as a journalist. He won his first Pulitzer reporting on the U.S. government loyalty program and the firing of an employee because of it. His second Pulitzer was for his coverage of the United States Supreme Court. His book, Gideon's Trumpet, examined the court's decision to grant poor defendants the right to have an attorney, even when they couldn't afford it. His new book, Freedom for the Thought We Hate, is a pithy and thought-provoking essay about the First Amendment. Well, Anthony Lewis, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It is my pleasure to be here.
As a journalist, you've been interested in First Amendment issues for a long time and have kind of chosen it as your beat. What first got you interested in these issues?
Well, it's probably a question of how deep you want to go. Do I have to lie down on a couch? I think for some reason I always, from childhood on, rooted for the underdog in athletic contests and life. And so it was kind of natural for me to eventually focus on the Constitution as the protection against abuse by majorities and the powerful and the government. I also always wanted to be a journalist. I mean, as far back as I remember, I was a high school editor, a college editor. So the two really combine in a focus on the First Amendment.
In your book, Freedom for the Thought We Hate, you call it a biography of the First Amendment. What do you mean by a biography?
I mean that it's not just a history. It's an analysis of the amendment as it has been applied in different areas of our lives. The First Amendment has 14 rather straightforward-sounding words. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Those are the two clauses I'm concerned with. There are others about religion and so on, but there are 14 words about freedom of speech and press. And, in fact, I should say but rather than and, the amendment is far from straightforward. It was added to the Constitution in 1791. Nobody claiming the protection of the amendment's right to speak or publish freely won a case in the Supreme Court until 1931. That's 140 years. And then, over the next 60 years or so, the Supreme Court applied the amendment in a vast range of circumstances. And the real meaning of the amendment has been spelled out by the courts. It's judges to whom we owe our freedom to say rancid speech, to print government secrets, and so on and so on.
It's had a very checkered history. I mean, 1931, even after that, there have been times when the pendulum has swung away from more free speech to less, talk about the differing approaches or the differing ideas and even the differing extent of free speech of the First Amendment in American history. If you could kind of sum up for us a little bit of this range of views.
The amendment really came to the attention, shall we say, of the Supreme Court, which of course has the last word on these issues, during World War I. And in that war, President Wilson, who was very bad on civil liberties, had no interest in civil liberties, and proposed the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act, which sent hundreds of people to prison for the most innocuous things, particularly for criticizing President Wilson. So that was a low point. And it was in that period that the first Supreme Court opinion treating free speech as a fundamental American value was published, Justice Holmes's opinion in 1919. But that was a dissent. And the court itself did not, as I said earlier, adopt that view, the view of free speech as fundamental to our values, for another dozen years. And, you know, during wars and times of tension, the court tends to fall back, to yield to majority and state oppression, and notably during the McCarthy period when the court was not very brave and upheld convictions of people for not disclosing members of the Communist Party and so on. And then afterwards, it's as if the court, along with the country, came to regret the excesses of a period of fear or war, and once again began building on the tradition, the true tradition of the First Amendment.
And this true tradition, you talk about a case that happened very early on in the 18th century with a printer, John Peter Zenger. It might surprise people to know that there was a case made against him because not because he himself authored the speech, but because he printed it. Could you talk a little bit about that case?
Back in the 18th century, printers were quite important because there were no great newspaper establishments as we think of them today, or, of course, broadcast networks. There were simply people wrote out what they wanted to say and took it to a printer, a job printer. And Zenger was one of those, a German-born printer in New York. And he printed a newspaper which was very critical of the royal governor of New York. There was no First Amendment at the time, of course. There was no United States. We're talking about the colonial period. And the printer was charged with sedition, seditious libel, criminal libel. And that happens to be an old English legal category, which had a unique and devastating feature. Truth was not a defense. Even if Zenger could prove that all the bad things said about the governor were true, that didn't help him under the law. And the judge charged the jury exactly that way. And the jury's only job was to decide whether he had printed it, which was really not in question. But the jury, called to its, courage by the lawyer for Zenger, who was a great Philadelphia lawyer named Andrew Hamilton, who said to them, ignore the law and find that for the defendant, find Zenger innocent because, in fact, what it said about the governor was true. Even though the law says that's irrelevant, free him. And the jury did.
Sedition. Many people may think that the great battles of free speech have been fought over things like obscenity or hate speech. But it seems from reading your book, Freedom for the Thought We Hate, that a more common theme has, in fact, been all the way through this issue of sedition. So tell us what sedition is first.
Well, sedition is, at its heart, an activity. It may be speech or it may be something else, but very often it's speech designed to damage or bring down the government. And it's such a loose term that people are prosecuted or have been prosecuted for seditious acts or seditious speech with very little, you know, concern for whether the speech actually did any harm. The case that is the exemplar is the case that brought the first great opinion from the Supreme Court I mentioned earlier in 1919. The case is called Abrams against the United States, and it was the facts were that a group of radicals threw pamphlets from the roof of a building in New York criticizing President Woodrow Wilson for sending troops to Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution. Now, that was political criticism, criticism of a president's policy. You can hardly imagine anything more central to the idea of the First Amendment, freedom of speech. It was certainly James Madison would have regarded it as absolutely free, James Madison, the author of the First Amendment. But they were prosecuted under Wilson's Espionage Act and Sedition Act and convicted and sentenced to 20 years in prison for throwing those pamphlets, anonymous pamphlets that Justice Holmes in his dissent called puny anonymities.
That case was the great one, the exemplar, as you say, but there were even many cases of people who just, you know, said they didn't want to buy bail bonds, you know, while they were drinking in a bar, they kind of got a little drunk and said something, and then they went to jail as well.
Those were examples I gave from the Montana Sedition Act. Most states adopted little state sedition laws like the federal sedition law, and literally thousands of people were sent to prison for such innocent acts as the one you just described.
Now, those may seem pretty absurd, looking backwards from where we are now, but you say that the freedom of speech may be in doubt now, and specifically around this issue of sedition. Could you talk a little bit? In fact, what you say is the response to it, these sedition laws, are the political use of fear to justify repression. So that sounds more contemporary.
It does, but today we have a different problem, I think. We don't have today the classic putting people in jail because they criticize the president. We're all criticizing the president, and we don't go to jail for that reason. The fear stems from something else, and it's the expansive use of presidential power, the assertion that the president can do things without any authority from Congress, the torture of prisoners, which is certainly, from my point of view, the low point of American history. That a president should order his agents to torture prisoners, to me it's unthinkable. The holding of people, including American citizens, in detention without trial, those are all acts that cause fear. They're not the traditional kind of punishment for what you say. They're punishment for what you may be because somebody suspects you, but you don't get a trial. You don't get any hearing. You don't have a judge look at your case. It's all done by the president and his agents, which is very scary.
And we're speaking with Anthony Lewis. He holds the James Madison Chair on First Amendment Issues at the Columbia School for Journalism. He's a journalist and author of Freedom for the Thought We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. And yet people also are being thrown or put on things like the no-fly list if they do engage in what we might think of as free speech activities.
Well, they may have done nothing because they don't get any hearing. They don't know what it is they're supposed to have done. That's the worst thing about something like the no-fly list. I agree with you. It's an outrage. You just go to an airport and you can't get on a plane. Why? They don't tell you.
And also librarians who... Well, maybe that's not quite a free speech issue, but, you know, actually...
It's quite close, I think.
Yeah, say something
about
it.
The library case situation arises under the Patriot Act, which authorizes the FBI to issue what are called national security letters. They can take one of those to a library and demand to know what books you read, what books you've taken out from that library. And the person they serve this piece of paper on is not allowed to tell anybody else about it or go to court or do anything except give the FBI the answer. And, of course, they don't tell you. So your reading habits are being scrutinized without your knowledge.
So it's not so much free speech, but something very akin to it, and that is access knowledge.
I think that's true.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have a question about a conundrum that I think often surfaces around the issue of free speech, and that has to do with hate speech.
Sure.
If, for example, the Ku Klux Klan has expressed hate speech, people can argue that this can, in fact, damage the social fabric, can lead, in fact, to atrocities, or can lead to the violation of individual rights. And others argue that if you give an inch, then those who want to take away the right of free speech will then use that as precedent and use that to oppress all of us.
You have stated why being a judge is a hard job. You have to balance the very interests that you have described. Of course, there are moments when speech is so hateful and so imminently close to causing real harm, that it can be punished or stopped. And the Supreme Court has laid down a formula for that, even though formulas don't always answer every case, but the formula is that you can punish speech if it calls for violation of law or revolution and intends to bring the harm about imminently and is likely to achieve that result to an audience that, shall we say, is a tinderbox, ready to go out and kill people, as in a Ku Klux Klan situation, or today, as in the example I use in the book of an imam preaching in London, which is an actual case, the need to blow up airplanes as part of jihad. And somebody from that congregation, a man named Richard Reed, actually goes out and tries to blow up an airplane. He was the shoe bomber. And then you can punish that kind of speech because it's so imminently close to doing real harm. That's the formula. But, of course, the facts always make it hard to fit the formula to the result.
Well, you began this interview saying that you've always been for the underdog. And I wonder if this might come into play, this issue of who is the speech for, come into play in parsing out rights that may be opposing to each other. And I'm thinking now of the shield law for journalists, which is another controversial issue. Two recent cases that are very different, one that actually did go to court, the other one that I know from talking with the reporter, he was afraid it would go to court, are, on the one hand, Judith Miller. She was a reporter for the New York Times, who, well, was one of the reporters who had in her notes the name of Valerie Plame, was seen by many people as protecting the administration. And on the other hand, Eric Lichtblau, another reporter for the New York Times, who won the Pulitzer for his reporting on the warrantless wiretapping. And I spoke with him recently, and he said, you know, that he was quite fearful that he might end up spending some time in jail because he would not give up his sources when the administration was trying to find the leak that he drew on for his reporting on warrantless wiretapping. So here's my question. Well, I guess I'd like you to talk about the use of the shield law in these two questions, and then maybe you'll answer my question before I have to ask it.
Now, let me say first that Lichtblau is, it's not theoretical. His colleague James Risen has been subpoenaed for information on his sources for a chapter of a book he wrote on the very same thing.
That's so, right, and they actually co-wrote those
they
reports.
They co-wrote the stories, and Risen wrote a book, and he's been subpoenaed, and he faces the very issue. It's not theoretical. Well, I think when you have a reporter who is disclosing lawlessness on the part of the government, because that wiretapping was done in direct violation of a criminal statute, which said that you had to get a warrant from a special court in order to do that wiretapping, and the president simply ignored the statute or instructed his subordinates to violate the statute. I think when you're a reporter and you disclose that kind of lawlessness and abuse of power by the government, you can only get the facts from anonymous sources because nobody inside the government, a relatively small number of people, would know about that secret program. And you couldn't possibly expect one of those few who knew about it to come to you and say, Eric, here's a story, and I want you to print my name as a source because I'd like to get the glory of telling you. Nobody's going to say that because you'll be immediately fired and maybe prosecuted. So they're all going to want to say, I can only tell you this in confidence. And I think it's very important to protect the sources in that kind of case. On the other hand, in the Judith Miller case, she never actually wrote anything, so it's a rather confusing case. She just had some things in her notes. But there was, as you said, some suggestion, some implication that she was actually carrying the water of the administration on her shoulders, that she was part of became privy to an effort by Vice President Cheney and his people to smear Valerie Plame's husband because he had written a story saying that President Bush had used false information about supposed nuclear weapons in Iraq. So the reason to keep her sources secret seemed less compelling to me, and it was less compelling to the judges who passed on it.
So is this really the distinction, that basically we go back to the purpose of the freedom of speech or the laws protecting free speech and free thought.
And it's not the distinction today. First of all, you can't go to the whole law of the First Amendment. The Shield cases are very special, and they're a very controversial area of law, and they're sui generis, shall I say. The idea that you should decide Shield cases on the basis of the purpose of the publication of information without a source, a named source, is not part of the law now, not the established law, but it has been proposed by one or two judges very forcefully, and the courts have begun acting as if that should be the test. They haven't formally said so, but there's a lot of talk about that being the proper test.
And does that go to the larger issue of the purpose of free speech? Is the purpose of free speech to protect society's ability, the people's ability to speak truth to power?
That's one purpose. It's a very large purpose, and it certainly was dominant in James Madison's mind. He was acutely conscious of the danger of a majoritarian society. He was helping to introduce, for the first time in the world, a society based on representative institutions in which the people would have the ultimate sovereignty. And he was afraid that a majority of the people would be abusive and would abuse minorities and punish people with different views. He was acutely conscious of that danger. And so what you just said, speak truth to power, was a dominant motive on his part in drafting the amendment. But the amendment's been used for lots of other things, to keep free the publication of artistic works, to allow James Joyce's Ulysses to be published after years of being repressed, and so on and so on. There are many other reasons for freedom. Freedom of mind, freedom of poetry, freedom of art.
And we're talking with journalist Anthony Lewis about his book, Freedom for the Thought We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. Now, looking ahead, I guess I go back to one of my very first questions. You say that the freedom of speech is in doubt. You have studied the Supreme Court very closely. Right now, it's many decisions hang in the balance. What do you see ahead? What do you see in terms of the stakes around free speech in the next election?
Here again, I think we have to understand that there's something slightly different from freedom of speech that's preoccupying the Supreme Court today. The issues that are coming to the Supreme Court that have aroused the most controversy and the most, to me, the most important test of American values aren't free speech in the traditional sense, but they involve the right of the government to keep people prisoner without a trial, to deny them any form of judicial hearing, to deny them habeas corpus, which is the right to go to court to protest your imprisonment. And those aren't traditional free speech cases. The interesting thing historically is that freedom of speech, in the traditional sense, the kind that evoked the great dissent of Justice Holmes that I mentioned earlier, and that I might, if I get a moment, quote from, those cases are not before the court so much anymore, for a simple reason, because freedom of speech in that traditional sense has become endorsed from right to left in American society. Conservatives, just as much as liberals, favor letting people speak today. That wasn't true traditionally. Conservatives were very repressive, and all of the early cases, like the one Holmes dissented in, were cases in which conservatives kept, you know, really very innocent speech from being uttered or punished it. But today, I think there's a general agreement that it's good to let people speak out. But the issues come down to the ones about presidential power and torture and detention without trial. Those are the crucial issues, I think. And those are a very important aspect of the next election because, you know, presidents appoint Supreme Court justices and what their appointments change the law. That's our system.
And you said you had a quote from Holmes related to this.
The traditional free speech doctrine developed really starting with Holmes's opinion in the case I mentioned earlier about the radicals who threw pamphlets from the roof of a building in New York and was sent to prison for 20 years. And Holmes said, persecution for the expression of opinions seems to me perfectly logical. He's only talking about the expression of opinions, you see. If you have no doubt of your premises or your power and want a certain result with all your heart, you naturally express your wishes in law and sweep away all opposition. But when men have realized that time has upset many fighting faiths, they may come to believe, even more than they believe the very foundations of their own conduct, that the ultimate good desired is better reached by free trade in ideas. That, at any rate, is the theory of our Constitution. It is an experiment, as all life is an experiment. While that experiment is part of our system, I think that we should be eternally vigilant against attempt to check the expression of opinions that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death.
Anthony Lewis, author of Freedom for the Thought We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment, thanks so much for speaking with us here on Writer's Voice.
I've enjoyed it a lot, and your questions were wonderful.
Anthony Lewis holds the James Madison Chair on First Amendment Issues at the Columbia University School for Journalism. Next up, Drew Adamek talks with Edward Ball about the inventor and the tycoon. Stay tuned after the break.
Love, it is a wounded bird, quiet whisper I have heard, a letter written with no words, read by crazy faith. A fiddle with a broken string, a song with only angels sings, a church bell that may never ring, except by crazy faith. I lit my love and watched it burn, asking nothing in return, except the lessons I would learn by holding crazy faith. Now I'm touched by that bright fire, down to the root of my desire. Now the smoke, it rises higher on crazy faith. Going to dawn on my crazy faith. The questions will not let me sleep, answers buried way too deep, at the bottom of a lover's leap, made by crazy faith.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Drew Adamek up now in conversation with author Edward Ball about his book, The Inventor and the Tycoon.
The Inventor and the Tycoon, A Gilded Age Murder and the Birth of Moving Pictures by Edward Ball, is the story of a strange partnership that helped create our media-saturated culture. The book chronicles the story of Leland Stanford, railroad magnate, governor of California, and founder of Stanford University, and Edward Muybridge, itinerant photographer, artist, and sensational murderer, as they partner to create the first moving pictures in the 1870s. Their innovation centered on a single question: do all four horses' hooves leave the ground during a trot? Stanford owned an enormous stable of racehorses and wanted to know the answer to that question. He hired Muybridge to create a photo system that could capture a horse in motion. Muybridge constructed a complex system of 24 electromagnetically charged cameras that, for the very first time, froze the motion of a horse over a considerable distance. However, just as the two men began working together, Muybridge discovered that his wife was having an affair, and he murdered her lover. His trial was covered nationally by The New Telegraph and is one of the first national crime sensations. He was acquitted and then changed the American media landscape forever. He took the images of the trotting horse and created a projector that showed an audience in Leland Stanford's home, for the very first time in history, a series of moving images. Within 20 years of that exhibition, the modern image-based media was born. The Inventor and the Tycoon is a tale of innovation, intrigue, friendship, and betrayal. Historian Edward Ball weaves a complex yet engaging tale that covers the history of rough justice in the frontier, American photography, the creation of the Western Railroads, and most importantly, the birth of modern media. I spoke with Edward Ball about how these two diametrically opposite men came together to create our modern media, what their innovation means for us today, and how to get away with murder in the 1870s. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. It's good to be here.
This is an incredibly difficult interview to start because there are so many large issues at stake in this book. But I want to sort of start, much like you did in the book, by going back a little bit.
Yes.
How did you come to write about these two men, and how did you come to discover their impact on American media culture or global media culture?
It occurs to me that we're all image obsessed. We're constantly checking our phones. We are on the computer 6 or 10 hours a day. We're in front of televisions and movie screens, and then there are video game players. And it's as though we're living in a stream of moving images. Much of our daily lives are devoted to them. And I wanted to find the kind of birthplace of the moving image culture. And it turns out that it's long ago, in the 1870s, in California, with a photographer called Edward Muybridge and a railroad magnate called Leland Stanford. These are the first men, if you like, who put images in motion on a screen. And their story is very interesting. It involves a murder. It involves the first years of cowboy capitalism in the United States. It involves an eccentric artist. And it involves Thomas Edison. There are quite a lot of figures, as you say, in the story.
And these two central characters, and I'll ask about each individually, but Edward Muybridge, who is he when we first meet him in this book, and what has been the trajectory of his life at the point that he intersects with Leland Stanford?
He's an English-born photographer. He was born in 1830, southwest of London, came to the U.S. in 1850 at age 20. He went to California during the Gold Rush period, lands in San Francisco, becomes a bookseller. He takes an interest in photography in his mid-30s, and it's at age 36 or 37 that he reinvents himself as a photographer. He takes photographs of the great vistas of the West, such as Yosemite Valley, such as Alaska, such as the coast of the California shore, and he becomes well known as a landscape photographer. His pictures sell very well on the East Coast. And at a certain point, he meets Leland Stanford, who is the president of the Central Pacific Railroad. This is the company that built the western half of the Transcontinental Line, who is the richest man west of the Mississippi, and who is a horse collector. And they meet in about 1870.
And who is Leland Stanford at this point, and why is he important to the history, not only of the moving image, but of California?
Mr. Stanford is himself a creature of reinvention. He was born in 1824 in Albany, just outside of Albany, New York, son of farmers, lower-ranking, middle-class family. He has four or five brothers. He is the only one his parents choose to give a higher education to. They can only afford to educate one of their sons. And he becomes an attorney. He first moves to the West, landing in Wisconsin in the 1840s, and becomes a small town lawyer in a new town on Lake Michigan. But this doesn't work out. After 2 or 3 years, he has married, but he's bored, and his brothers are all in California. During the Gold Rush, all of his siblings are writing him letters to Wisconsin saying, "Come to California. The getting is good here. We're making a lot of money." And they had gone to California, his brothers, first to dig gold, but then they became shopkeepers, selling mining equipment to the stream of tens of thousands of men who were coming west to look for gold and silver. Stanford moves to California and becomes a shopkeeper. He starts selling rice and groceries and pickaxes and liquor to miners in the hill, in the Sierra foothills, and he becomes quite prosperous. This would be 1850, 1855, and by the end of the 1850s, he's a very prosperous businessman in Sacramento.
Is Leland Stanford took advantage of an opportunity that was available to him, and how did he come to be involved in the railroad, and what was the impact that it had on not only his life, but the rest of the country?
He happens to be on the scene when a promoter of the railroads comes through to try to sell local rich men on the idea of building a railroad line. As we all know from our courses in high school history, it was impossible to get from the East Coast to the West Coast. You had to take a stagecoach across the middle of the frontier Indian country, and it might have taken you 2 months. Or you could go through Nicaragua. You could take a steamship from New York down to Nicaragua, take a mule train over the mountains of Central America, and then take another steamship up the west coast to San Francisco, and that would take you 6 weeks. So there was this desire for California to link itself to the eastern states. There was an attempt to build a railroad going on for 10 or 15 years, but in Congress, there was a political logjam. The northern congressional leaders would only vote money for a route that went through the north across the country. The southern congressional delegation would only want to build a route through New Orleans that went through the southern route. So there was no movement to subsidize the building of the track until the Civil War. And just by chance, when the Civil War broke out, all of the southern delegation left Washington and went south, which left a Congress dominated by northerners. Stanford's representatives from this investment scheme came to Washington and persuaded the congressional leaders to subsidize an enormous construction project that would link Missouri to Utah to California. And the western half of it was christened the Central Pacific Railroad, and the eastern end of it was the Union Pacific Railroad. Stanford was named president of this new paper company, and money began to flow from Washington, D.C. during the Civil War, and the railroad was built by some 25,000 Chinese immigrants. At the end of the 1860s, Stanford is a very rich man, and the railroad is finished. And at this point, he is also a politician. He has managed to get himself elected to the governor's office of California. So he's not only a prominent businessman in the West, he is a former governor with his fingers on all of the political buttons.
And these two men couldn't be different from each other, could they?
Stanford is a polished man. He likes to wear tuxedos. His shoes are shining like mirrors. He carries a gold-tipped cane. He wears a silk top hat. He is elegantly turned out, and he is also his personality is very remote. Everyone who meets him say he's almost wordless. He's phlegmatic. He has very little to contribute to the conversation. You would hardly hear anything in the room from him. But he meets this photographer, Muybridge, because he wants Muybridge to photograph his property. He hires Muybridge to photograph one of his mansions. Muybridge is an artist. He wears beat-up jackets. He has a beard down to the middle of his chest. His hair sticks out in all directions. It's white, and he combs it once a week. His strings on the cuffs of his pants. He smokes a corn cob pipe. He is the cultural opposite of Mr. Stanford, and he's nervous, thin as a rail, fast-talking. They become friends, curiously, and they began to spend a lot of time together. This is 1870, 71, 72. They are an unlikely pair.
You are listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Drew Adamack. Today, I'm talking with Edward Ball, author of The Inventor and the Tycoon. So they develop this friendship based on a professional working relationship, and then they set out to solve a mystery, much like great innovators of throughout history. They try to answer an unanswerable question. What is it that they're trying to do?
Stanford has become fascinated with a question that bothers horse lovers at this time, and that is, how do the hooves of a horse move during a gallop? It's too fast for the naked eye to see, and some people think that horses at some point become airborne when they're running with all four hooves off the ground, and some people say, no, they've always got one hoof on the ground. And this is known as the theory of unsupported transit at the time. And Stanford is an advocate of the theory that horses are actually flying at one moment during the gallop. And he hires Muybridge to try to answer this question. He says, Muybridge, I would like you to try to freeze the motion of a horse. And Muybridge says, well, I can't do that. Photography is not able to freeze the motion of a galloping horse. Stanford says, Muybridge, here's $50,000. Do what you have to do. And so he invites Muybridge to his horse farm. Muybridge builds a shed at Palo Alto, a very long shed with an open, uninterrupted window, and he puts 24 cameras inside of this shed, all pointing out at the track of the horse, where the horses will gallop. And he runs horses past these 24 cameras. And initially, there are strings running from each lens across the path of the track, and as the horse breaks each string, the camera's shutter is set off, and the horse photographs itself. But this is kind of blurry, and the result is unsatisfactory. And so he goes back to the drawing board.
As they're progressing in these experiments, Muybridge has then sort of a different set of problems in his personal life, doesn't he?
He does, yes. He's a middle-aged man. He's 42, I think. There's no evidence of any relationship in his life until this point. But at age 42, he meets and becomes involved with a much younger woman, a 21-year-old woman named Flora Downs, who works as a photographer's assistant in the gallery in San Francisco, where Muybridge sells his photographs. And they marry and move in together in a fancy neighborhood in San Francisco. But Muybridge is not a very attentive husband, and Flora Downs is a vivacious woman who likes the theater and who likes clothing. Muybridge likes to travel a lot, and he sleeps outdoors. And Muybridge, after marrying this woman, begins to travel again and neglects her. Within a year, she is having an affair with a man called Harry Larkins, who is a theater critic, a British-born theater critic, a kind of handsome swain on the stinking streets of San Francisco. And she and Larkins are having trysts in the hotels around town, and even in Muybridge's house. Muybridge finds out about the affair, and he goes into a rage. He takes his gun. Now, in California at that time, probably the majority of men had weapons. The murder rate in California was something like 100 times what it is today. And there was rough justice, to use an unpleasant euphemism. And Moyridge goes to the house of Harry Larkins, knocks on the door. When Larkins answers the door, he says, "Larkins, I have a message for you from my wife." And he shoots this man dead in the doorway of his house. There are 7 witnesses to this crime. Moyridge confesses to it. There's a sensational trial that takes place in January 1875. And if you were anywhere in the country, you would be reading about this trial, because the Telegraph made it possible to report the trial around the country. If you were in Baltimore, it was in the papers, in New Orleans, in New York, in Chicago. Moyridge gets an attorney who says, "We have to plead insanity." And Moyridge says, "I was not insane. I meant to kill the man." After a trial in which everyone knows the actual events, the jury acquits Moyridge on the basis of what used to be called justifiable homicide, which in this case, it's also known as the provocation defense. If someone provokes you, let's say by pulling a weapon on you, you have the justifiable motive to kill that person. And the provocation was widely interpreted as including adultery. So men in that day and age would often get off for killing their sexual rivals. I've never found a case where a woman was able to exercise the provocation defense and kill her sexual rival. But Moyridge was acquitted, and popularly so. It somehow raised his status in society. He was known as a macho husband who got away with doing away with his rival. He and his wife separate. His wife, within 6 or 8 months, Flora Downs, has contracted influenza, and she dies at age 24. And Moyridge, after this period of chaos, goes back to Mr. Stanford, who, circumstances suggest, Stanford has actually recruited Moyridge's lawyer and helped him get through this trial.
And where are they as far as making progress in this challenge that they're trying to solve?
Well, Moyridge had gotten a few fuzzy pictures, but nothing that could be printed and could demonstrate that horses are airborne during their gallop. So he goes back to the scene at Palo Alto, installs more cameras in his shed, devises an electronic, electromagnetic device that will shoot the shutters of 24 cameras in rapid sequence automatically at a precise interval of a quarter of a second between each exposure. And this is much more accurate. He manages to devise a kind of emulsion that is fast enough to arrest movement. And in the summer of 1877, he completes a series of photographs which show the movement of a horse in 12 images. And these are, if you stitch them together digitally today and run them rapidly, one after the other, they comprise the very first attempts at moving images.
And I'm sorry, what was the popular reaction to these images and to this innovation as Stanford and Moyridge start showing people these images?
Well, there was a sensational reaction. These pictures become famous almost overnight around the U.S., and Moyridge becomes the talk of many towns. They're published in Europe as well, and he's published as a kind of new guru of image making in such places as Scientific American magazine, in such popular places like Harper's Weekly. So he's converted himself once again from a landscape photographer into a kind of scientist, which is the way he presents himself now to people. He's the man who stopped motion, the man who split the second, and his photographs make him quite popular. Stanford loves this, and so Moybridge does more and more of the same stuff. He photographs dozens of Stanford horses in gallop. He photographs animals from the zoo. He photographs athletes doing tumbling, boxers boxing. And by 1880, he has a catalog of several hundred images that have arrested motion, and he calls them motion studies, as a scientist might do.
This is Writer's Voice. I'm Drew Adamack, and today I'm talking with Edward Ball about his book, The Inventor and the Tycoon. While the images themselves are a significant breakthrough, these two, and Moybridge in particular, they make one more innovation that is really important. And what is that that they do?
In 1880, he decides to build a projector that can animate these pictures, put them in motion. And he takes a magic lantern, which is a projector of slides of that day and age, and modifies it, puts these images on a disc, on a glass disc the size of a dinner plate, around the edge of the plate, and spins that plate in front of a projecting light. And what do we have on the screen are horses galloping and tumblers tumbling and women dancing and cats running across the screen and so forth. And he builds this projector and decides to debut it at Stanford's house in January 1880. And there's an extraordinary evening that goes off when Stanford, at his mansion on California Hill — we call it Knob Hill today, it was called California Hill at that time — where Stanford had built a 50-room, 50,000-square-foot house overlooking the city, he invites some of his rich friends, people who were rich from mining, from banking, and they sit in one of the over-decorated rooms of the Stanford mansion. They watch Moybridge introduce this projector, and it's, if you like, it's kind of a birthplace of moving images. One night in the home of a rich man in the winter of 1880.
So the two men who have created this thing together suddenly no longer are working together. They have a falling out. What happens between these two men to put an end to their relationship?
Moybridge is now quite popular, and he goes to Europe and becomes the toast of the town in London, in Paris, in Milan, in Berlin, where he's received by all the scientific societies, and he's in all the newspapers as a kind of miraculous cross between a scientist and showman. And Stanford, as it happens, is traveling in Europe at the same time that Moybridge is there in 1882, and Stanford is there to buy art and to buy jewelry. And I think he's made somewhat uncomfortable by his former protege's success and celebrity. Stanford was a man who's used to clamoring attention from the public, and he was a vain man. And so Stanford goes home from France, leaving Moybridge there, and he goes back to California, and immediately he publishes a book. He hires one of his friends to produce a book using Moybridge's images, and he more or less takes Moybridge's pictures without asking and includes them in this book, and publishes Moybridge's work on the movement of horses as though it's his, Stanford's own, and fails to mention Muybridge's name. Muybridge becomes very upset about this and files a suit against Stanford. And that brings the end to their relationship. Muybridge loses the lawsuit. Stanford is still a bigger fish than Muybridge is in courtroom. And their friendship comes to an end.
What impact has this relationship between Leland Stanford and Edward Muybridge had in their invention had or has on our current life?
Yes. Well, I think of it in two ways. It's another story of unintended consequences. These are collaborators on a project whose outcome no one could have dreamed and was almost accidental. If Muybridge and Stanford had not been able to put images in motion in the U.S., certainly it would have happened in the hands of some other people. And similar things were happening in Europe with other experimenters. Nevertheless, the other way I think about it is in terms of speed. Muybridge and Stanford were harbingers, if you like, of our own culture of speed and acceleration. By putting images in motion, they released the first trickle of the flood of images that came to engulf the popular culture. And the speed with which we consume images today, hundreds each day, thousands each day, is in some ways the result of the tinkering of these two men on a horse farm in California in the 1870s.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Good. I'm glad to have been here.
For Writer's Voice, I'm Drew Adamack.
Drew Adamack spoke with Edward Ball about his book, The Inventor and the Tycoon. It was published in January by Random House. And Drew and I want to send a big shout-out of thanks to all who sent in donations to our Kickstarter campaign. The campaign was about supporting our bi-monthly special series about the Connecticut River Valley, The River Runs Through Us. We had to come up with $600 to fulfill the conditions of a grant we received for the series from Mass Humanities, and to pay for some other costs. We're happy to report we exceeded our goal and have been able to heave a huge sigh of relief. Thanks so much. And tune in to our next episode of The River Runs Through Us. That's coming up next week on Writer's Voice. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.